This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The pictures coming out of the West African country of Niger are increasingly grim. Small children with bloated bellies and tired eyes, clusters of thin people waiting patiently for food. Thanks to the global media, the whole world knows what famine looks like, and every crisis reminds us of another depressing truth. We still don't seem to know how to prevent it. The current famine in Niger was easy to predict. Last year, the rains failed, locusts devastated what crops remained. But when the UN appealed to the world community for aid in November, the call went unanswered. More urgent pleas this spring did only a little better. Now that there's a crisis, the world has begun to mobilize substantial aid. Part of the reason is that there are other urgent appeals, as mass hunger looms in Sudan, Ethiopia, and elsewhere. If famine can be predicted, though, why is it so hard to prevent? And why does it happen in the first place? How much can be blamed on the environment, on war, on poor government, and on international institutions? Later in the program, we'll look at the issues in play as the deadline approaches for Iraq's new constitution. But first, understanding and fighting famine. If you have questions about the roots of famine and the tools to reduce it, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Dakar in Senegal is Natasha Quist, West Africa Regional Director for Oxfam, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
I understand you just returned from Niger yesterday. We read the statistics in the newspaper, 3.5 million people at risk of starvation. You've seen the people there. What's going on?
Yes, actually, I just got back last night. I have to say it's actually quite deceptive, because the rains have been falling over the last month. The rains have been coming on and off, and it's relatively green in this region. And most of the people affected are nomadic communities and communities who live off of the road. So it's not easy. From the images I've seen on the television here, you think you'd go into a village and you'd see everybody. The point is it's very difficult to get to some of these communities that have been cut off.
What have you personally seen? What is it like for these people to suffer through this famine?
I've been working in an area called Maradi, which is one of the most severely affected regions. I've been into some of Médecins Sans Frontières clinics. Some of the fortunate children have the chance to go into these clinics. And just to give you an idea, there's one little boy I saw. He's one of six children. Three of his brothers and sisters have already died, and his mother is there, hoping that Médecins Sans Frontières can help in intensive care. The problem is now she's not back in her field to attend her crops, and she has other children. So it's a spiral effect on this family.
Is there food there, or what are people doing?
You've heard the reports of people eating leaves and grass, and that there isn't anything to eat in some of these communities. They can dig up roots. There are some leaves that have some nutritional value. Some people have gone into debt, sold their cows if they can, and just trying to make do on things they can dig out of the ground. I've even seen people knocking down ant hills, some of the termite hills, because they've actually got bits of grain inside of them.
How did this come about? What factors? We heard about the drought last year, but are there other factors that contributed to this famine?
There's also the locust invasion. But it's more than last year. The year before that, there's also very poor rains. And then last year, the rains pretty much failed. Then you had the locust invasion. And you speak to some people, people knew that because of the harvest being so poor last year, that they wouldn't have enough to last them through to this year. And some of the families I spoke to said that they went down to one meal a day in December and January last, at the beginning of the year. They went down to one meal a day for the family because they knew they had to last through to October.
That doesn't give them much resistance when it gets even worse, though, does it?
Absolutely. So can you imagine the effect on a child since 8-9 months now eating one meal a day, and even that isn't a big meal, and now you've got rains, and in some area that means you're going to have all these water-bound viruses, especially malaria, so you're malnourished, and then you also don't have the resistance now to things like malaria. So it's, again, another spiral.
Some reports have suggested that the government in Niger downplayed the threat of famine because of national elections late last year. Is that fair?
I don't want to comment on this, but you do have to remember that Niger is one of the most poor countries in the world. The only other country that is as poor as listed is Liberia. So you can imagine the capacity of a government that has 11 million people, 12 million people to take care of. Their capacity to respond to such a huge crisis is limited.
I assume you don't necessarily want to comment on that because you have to try to work in that country.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, though, about some of Niger's neighbors, Mali, Burkina Faso, Mauritania. They're also at risk?
Absolutely. The difference, I would say that maybe the governments and maybe the World Food Programme, the UN, maybe had a head start on working in Mauritania and Mali. But one of the other reasons why we're talking about Niger as much is because there are 12 million people. Mauritania, for instance, is only 2 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So in absolute terms, there are many more people in Niger, so this is going to affect many more people. About a third of the population is in crisis. Almost a quarter, actually, in Niger. We compare to Mauritania, 2 million people. So I understand now in Mauritania, it's almost half the population is in crisis.
Thanks very much. Let me ask you, though, one final question. Is aid beginning to arrive? Is aid the answer?
It's not the only answer. There are many things that have to happen to support Niger to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And I'm most worried about what happens next year. The rains have come late. The seeds have been washed away. People are too tired to tend their fields. And I don't think the harvest is going to be so great in October. It'll take a miracle to have a great harvest. So we're again in another spiral.
Natasha Quist, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Natasha Quist is the West Africa Regional Director for Oxfam, and she joined us from her office in Dakar in Senegal. We're joined here in Studio 3A by Mark Cohen, a research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, an organization dedicated to finding policy solutions for worldwide hunger and malnutrition. And it's good of you to join us today on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
Let me ask you the question that Natasha Quist did not want to answer. Does politics in places like Niger play a role in malnutrition, in famine?
Well, I think most famines result not just from natural conditions such as drought and locusts, but from economic, social, and political factors, absolutely. And in situations of armed conflict, famine may be used as a weapon of war, even. I mean, that's certainly the situation in Darfur on the other side of Africa.
And sometimes food aid is used as a weapon of, if not war, either political manipulation or favoritism.
Absolutely. That's correct.
Now, droughts happen all over the world. Last year's locust swarms also affected Australia and Asia. Why is West Africa particularly susceptible to famine?
Well, I think as we heard from Ms. Quist of Oxfam, first of all, Niger is a very poor country. Most of the people there live on less than a dollar a day, the equivalent of less than a dollar a day. They depend on agriculture for a living. Very little of the land is suitable for farming. You have a significant proportion of the population living off of livestock, so there's actually competition over what good land there is for feed and food crops.
And grazing, I assume.
Absolutely. And so it's a very difficult situation. It's very fragile. It's one of the poorest countries in the world, so if there isn't an appropriate and timely external response to a situation like this, as there should have been last November, then a situation like we've got now is likely to happen.
Is there any easy way, even if food aid arrives from outside, to distribute it?
Well, this is a problem in many poor countries, especially in Africa. You often, if you're dealing with a landlocked country, it's hard to get from a port to where the people in need are. Even if there is a port in the country, the road system may not be very good. So it isn't an easy proposition. And the longer you wait, the more difficult things become, as we've seen.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. We're discussing the roots of famine and the tools we need to fight it. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. We'll begin with Anthony. Anthony calling from Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, hi, thanks.
Sure.
What I wanted to ask about was essentially if famine is directly tied to population control and overpopulation. And again, I don't want to seem like I'm blaming all the problems in the world on Bush, but I remember one of the first actions that Bush took was he did a significant Planned Parenthood for aid to Africa. And I just, not to say that there's a correlation in that, but do you think that maybe we need to have a little more Planned Parenthood for the third world to head off crises like this?
Mm-hmm. Mark Cohen?
Well, that's a very old debate, whether famine is caused by too many people and not enough food. On the other hand, a child born in the United States is going to consume a lot more resources over his or her lifetime than a child born in Niger. So I don't think that's the prime cause of what's going on here, even though Niger has one of the highest population growth rates in the world. But certainly, the more restrictive the population policy is, the more difficult it is to deal with these kinds of situations. I mean, we want to have access to reproductive health care for poor women. We want to prevent the spread of AIDS also. If you say there's no condoms can be shipped, that obviously makes it more difficult to prevent AIDS. It makes it more difficult to engage in family planning.
You also want to prevent measles, all kinds of infectious diseases, and improvements in sanitation have also contributed to population growth.
Absolutely. And poverty is the biggest contributor. If you're very poor, you don't have a social security system, the only way you're going to have someone to take care of you in your old age is to have lots of children and hope a few of them survive.
Yes. Is the lack of education as far as the best ways to use the soil and optimize their crop rotation, things of that nature?
I mean, that's part of a problem, I'd say, globally. In Africa, farmers often can't afford to use fertilizer. Their animals don't produce enough manure, so they're actually taking more nutrients out of the soil than they're putting in. That's also a problem, again, driven primarily by poverty.
But I've also read that outside agronomists are often humbled by when it turns out that the local people know how to use their land better than outsiders.
Yes, they do the best they can in the circumstances they live in. That's also correct. Mm.
Okay, well, thank you.
Anthony, thanks very much for the phone call. And we'll be joined by more of you after we return from a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The famine in Niger has finally reached into the headlines, while several other mass hungers loom across Africa. Today, we're learning more about the brutal intersection of weather, politics, economics, and fate that leaves so many people hungry, and why the world isn't better at addressing what seems like such a basic problem. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. If you've worked in famine relief, call and tell us about your experience. If you have questions about what leads to famine and what may help to cure it, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Mark Cohen, research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. And let's get another caller on the line. Eddie joins us. Eddie calling from Atlanta in Georgia.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment about this situation, that it happens year after year. I think the really basic problem is that humanity has lost its humanity. There's no heart anymore. The world is controlled by elite and powerful, and these so-called intellectuals are so corrupt. It doesn't matter in a democratic or non-democratic government. They all are really pursuing the power and money, and the majority of the money is collected in the hands of the few. And as long as humanity is in this phase of this type of greed and power accumulation, the people weak and the poor will suffer. When a powerful country like the United States, when it spends $300 billion or more in a war of destruction that could solve a lot of these problems in the world, the humanity has to come to understand that we are in one world and we have to help each other to survive and make a better living for everybody. It's going to, that's why the terrorism, that's all this destruction is going on. And the human being has become a degenerative being that without the, creative people being in the position of power and position of making decisions, this thing will go on forever and finally will come to, hurt the one that they have, money and power, because we are one society, one world.
Mark Cohen, Eddie is hardly alone in his prescription.
I think that's right. I think there's some contrasting views on what Eddie's saying. On the one hand, As the UN humanitarian coordinator, Jan Englund, said, the appeal for Niger is about 20 minutes worth of global military spending. The United Nations is looking for $30 million there, so there's evidence that way. On the other hand, the response to the tsunami last December, I mean, there was certainly an outpouring of humanitarian feeling from people all over the world, so I'm a little more optimistic about humanitarianism, I think.
NPR's Africa correspondent Jason Beaubien joins us now from Johannesburg in South Africa. Jason, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us.
No problem, Neil.
I understand you just got back from Zimbabwe, which is having food problems of its own, though that seems to have different root causes from the situation that we're talking about in West Africa.
No, it's true. Across Africa, the different food problems that you see in different parts are all driven by different things, and they're all fairly unique in terms of the different regions. Up in Niger, it's been driven by drought, been driven by locusts. In Zimbabwe, you get a strange combination of poor governance and governmental systems, which have really caused many of the food problems, seizure of commercial farmlands, very chaotic redistribution of land in an attempt to essentially set up sort of subsistence farmers again on what used to be very profitable, large white-owned farms and redistributing that land to blacks. But also in Zimbabwe, you have the issue of AIDS. And in southern Africa in particular, AIDS is very much a driving force in hunger throughout the region, that people are getting sick. The really productive people are not. Many of them are not healthy. You know, in places it's up to 35%. And that is cutting down on the productive capacity of subsistence farmers in many parts of Africa. And when you've got people living already very much on the edge, when you've got 35% of the population infected, that doesn't mean that 35% can't go out and work the fields. But, you know, even if 5 or 10% no longer can go out and work the fields, that means that their children aren't getting fed. The burden falls to relatives. So AIDS and HIV is also an issue, particularly for southern Africa. It's affecting the overall hunger situation in some of the countries here.
Mm-hmm. When you travel through these countries, what do people tell you they think would help solve this problem?
Well, most people usually tell me that they want the West to come in and just send in food, send in money. That's usually what I hear from when I'm talking to peasants out in the countryside. Oftentimes you don't have a extremely high education level, but also there's this feeling that, you know, in the West, you guys have everything. You drive cars, you can go to the supermarket, you can get food, you go and you just turn on the tap and you get hot water, and look at us here. So the gulf between these people who end up being the people who suffer the most in times of famine, their lives are so different from the West that they have this vision that the West should just be able to come in here and magically change it and fix the problem. And that's what they usually hope for. Governments tend to be, sometimes they also want the same thing. They would love for people to come in and bring in lots and lots of resources, but usually it's a more nuanced approach and they view it in terms of help from the West, in terms of development aid, setting up more infrastructure projects, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question. This from Kendall in Miami. He writes, I'm wondering if you could speak to the introduction of non-native crops in West Africa and to their effect on local crops and markets. Mark?
Well, I don't think that's so much part of the problem at the moment. I mean, when you've had a crop failure, it's not a question of new species invading. But you know, the food crops of the world today are often growing far away from their point of origin. I mean, people in Africa eat cassava, which had its origin in the Western Hemisphere. People eat rice all over the world. So I think it isn't necessarily a question of relying only on indigenous species. It's on crops that can do well, crops that are hardy and can resist drought, crops that are easier to protect from an onslaught of locusts. So I think actually agricultural research on finding crops that will do well in difficult environments is an important part of the long-term solution.
Mark, can I ask you something about that, though? I mean, to what degree are you getting these types of crops in Africa? I don't feel like I'm seeing a whole lot of that as I travel around. I mean, in some places, Kenya is doing some things, but I don't feel like I'm seeing much of that happening in Africa. What's your take?
No, I think there is some. I mean, and particularly if we're talking about genetically modified crops, there are only a few countries in Africa currently growing those. But even the spread of hybrid forms of, for example, corn, that requires farmers to purchase seeds every year for the most part. So for very poor farmers, that's difficult. There has been some success with hybrid corn in Kenya and some other countries, but I think we're a bit away from widespread planting of those in Africa. We need to overcome some of these problems like poor roads and whatnot first.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Karen. Karen calling us from Boston.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for your program. I'm enjoying it very much.
Thank you.
I had a comment regarding, well, first of all, I just want to say I do agree that the situation that we're discussing here is very unique in each community, because Africa is a huge continent, and oftentimes there are people that tend to discuss Africa as a community itself, which I think that it's very important to consider that these situations are each unique, and that when many Americans desire to contribute through, as you were saying, Live Aid or charities or donating to NGOs or look to NGOs or agencies to solve the problem of these communities that are living in extreme poverty, I think there's a couple of points to consider, and first of all, just that concept of solving a problem or saving a community from its own demise is troubling. For example, just, again, agreeing with someone who spoke earlier and saying that it's not necessarily the communities themselves that are the problem, but it is the situation that they have been placed in terms of their position in the greater capitalist world economy. But secondly, and my last point is just also for us all to consider our own role as communities in America in our consumption habits, that I believe that is a really crucial part of this equation that frequently gets left out of these discussions and needs to be considered, because instead of taking the Malthusian approach to understanding these development problems and saying it's primarily overpopulation or, you know, it's only environmental, these are important things to discuss, but we're missing a massive part of this problem when we don't discuss surplus and consumption habits of other countries, for example, America or the UK or Germany, et cetera.
The developed world you're talking about, Karen, but surely the answer for people in Africa is to increase their production and develop their economies to make them more productive rather than for farmers in the Midwest or Australia to divert some of their crops to Africa.
Well, I'm not saying that crops should necessarily be diverted. When I talk about our consumption habits, I mean in terms of people needing 50 pairs of jeans instead of 5, or people, because these are all part of this equation, although it doesn't seem obvious at first, the fact that when we look at the textile industry, when we look at these industries, even the labor industry globally, and how this is connected to our consumption habits and the situation that a number of these communities end up in the world economy, there's a definite link. And yes, communities do need to be productive, but I do believe they should be productive on their own terms, and they should decide for themselves what that productivity will be, instead of an agency like World Bank or USAID or whoever coming in with structural adjustment programming or contingency monies that say, here's money, you need education, that's what your community needs, and this is how you should do it. It's a little extreme. There has been a little growth and development in the approach of these agencies, and I know there's been a lot of participatory development endeavors that have gone on, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but nonetheless, we still have an awful lot of contingency going on, and I do think this inhibits communities from enabling their own the own fulfillment of their own goals and their own dreams and their own hopes to being a sustainable community as they see it.
Karen, thanks very much for the call. Mark, do you have a comment on
yes.
that?
Yes. I think the point that both you and Karen made is that the solutions lie in Africa. One of the reasons we have a difficult situation in Niger now is that by waiting beyond the November appeal, people have eaten their seeds, they've sold their livestock. So reviving agriculture, making the jump from relief to development, is going to be that much more difficult. People no longer have assets, and so it's going to be difficult to revive the livelihoods within the affected communities. And I think a timely response to an event like this is critical for that reason.
We're talking about famine and what to do about it. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Jason Bobian, let me bring you back into the conversation. We're discussing situations where people didn't respond in time and situations are going out of control. Are there examples that you know of where crisis was predicted and averted?
I think certainly. All across the continent at the moment, the World Food Program is distributing food in many areas where if they weren't, you would be seeing huge problems. In Swaziland, here in southern Africa, again, it has an extremely high HIV rate. It's also been hit by a drought. They're in there distributing food to AIDS orphans. And so these don't ever rise to the point where you have emaciated children on television, because these aid agencies are there, they're active in the community, and they're getting food into many of these places. And all across the continent, you see that at refugee camps, in various places. Aid is working to avert having starvation, to having incredible famine. But at the same time, you do have a huge aid machine that has been functioning in Africa for, you know, three decades, four decades. And I think that the overall question of this debate during this hour is a good one about what is the appropriate response. And certainly the answers, and I don't feel like I have the answer necessarily, but certainly the responses in the past haven't set up infrastructure and sort of inoculated this continent against famine.
Mm-hmm. Mark Cohen, let me ask you. We used to read of and hear of famines in Asia. Development has largely mitigated a lot of those problems. Are there lessons to be learned from there that can be applied to Africa?
Yes. I think if we talk about India, which used to be viewed as a basket case and a place where famines happened regularly, one of the lessons there is the response to drought and other problems in many of the states in India is to put people to work on public works projects, to rehabilitate roads, to take care of things. But the point is to put money in people's pockets so that they can buy food on the market. Usually famine is not a result of crop failure. It's a result of people being unable to buy food. There may be food in the country. There may be food that can be imported. But if people can't access that through some kind of income and by being put to work when they lose their jobs, that's when difficulties happen. And this is not an original point with me. The Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen has written a lot about this. And I think the idea of making sure that people continue to participate in the economy where that's feasible is a very important way to prevent famines from getting out of hand, keep them from happening.
And one final email before we have to go. This is from Joel in San Francisco. Microcredit lending could help alleviate famine. When the world's poorest people, especially women, have access to credit at low interest rates, they have working capital to start and expand small businesses, providing an income stream which can help themselves and their families to afford food and other necessities in good times and in bad. Jason, we have only a few seconds left, but I wonder, have you seen evidence of any of that working?
I have. I have seen some microcredit programs that have done wonders, completely transformed both the status of the women in the community, made it much higher, which is a very important thing at times in Africa, and also given them access to the money that they need to get more money into their households and thus be able to feed their children. So, yes, I've seen some great examples of that across Africa.
Jason, thanks very much. We know what time it is there. We appreciate you staying up to be with us.
You're welcome.
Jason Bobian covers Africa for NPR. He joined us from his home in Johannesburg. And Mark Cohen, it's just the middle of the afternoon in Washington, but we appreciate your time as well.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Mark Cohen is a research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute and joined us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a break, we'll look inside the drafting of the Iraqi Constitution. It's due in a little less than 3 weeks. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.